Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where this week we're talking about the Nancy Walker episode of The Muppet Show, which was originally broadcast in New York City 45 years ago today on October 24th, 1977. Pete, this is a bingo.
Is it?
This is the sixth production episode and is the sixth aired episode of the season.
Oh, that's fun.
We had two bingos last season and two horseshoes, where the episode was almost, but not quite.
Oh, okay. That wasn't what I was going to guess it meant, but I get it now.
Ruth Buzzi and Phyllis Diller both had production episode and broadcast order episodes in New York, the same. And Bruce Forsyth was one off. He was broadcast number 12, but production episode number 13.
Hmm.
This season, we have three bingos and two horseshoes.
Wow.
Do you want to know what the other ones are?
No. Let's reveal that as they come. I think that's more fun to introduce them as, here's another bingo.
So, welcome to the accidental circumstance that would be completely different if we were doing this in UK order and on UK dates.
Not necessarily, because I'm looking at this right now, and the UK date for this episode is October 28th.
That's right, it's a week later. Except it's a different day of the week.
It's true.
Yes. So it's next week, but on the day of the week that it aired in the UK on ITV.
Yes, which we still haven't, nor have I at least, done any research as to why the date changed.
Yes, I also did no research as to why Nancy Walker and
Steve Martin
get bumped to a different day of the week and then Don Knotts does later.
If I remember, I may take a look too, because I'm curious as to whether it's either sports related or Olympics related. Like, there are lots of things that...
It could be.
Wild speculation already.
How dare you? You love wild speculation so much, and yet you're going to find data that prevents you from wildly speculating?
Ben, I think we just wildly speculated about it, so
we didn't.
I can have my cake and eat it too.
That was not wild speculation. That was half-hearted speculation at best. That was definitely qualified as mild speculation.
Ben, you've read some of my school reports. Everything I do is half-hearted.
Well, that would make it child speculation, if it has to do with your school reports.
Yeah, all right.
Anyway, Nancy Walker, a person about which I know nothing, and an episode I had never seen prior to reviewing it for this season of the podcast. So your normal stats on Ben, you probably have never seen this sketch before, is literally true for all of them.
Well, I think there's only one thing about this that was cut from Nickelodeon. So we will have that segment later. Well, since you don't know anything about Nancy Walker, let me quiz you about the things you definitely don't know about her. And we're going to start with question one. Nancy Walker is not her real name.
Okay.
She was born Anna Myrtle Swoyer. She went for an audition and the casting director mistook her for another actress with the last name of Walker, and she just went with it. Once she got the part, she adopted the last name Walker and used her childhood nickname Nancy, which I could find no references about why they called Anna Nancy. But then, which actress was the intended Walker that the casting director was expecting? Amanda Walker, whose top four IMDb credits are 28 Weeks Later, Cloud Atlas, A Room with a View, and Wimbledon. Cheryl Walker, whose top four IMDb credits are Murder is My Business, Larceny in Her Heart, Three on a Ticket, and Stage Door Canteen. Or Helen Walker, whose top four IMDb credits are Call Northside 777, Impact, The Man in Half Moon Street, and Brewster's Millions.
Number three.
See, Helen Walker is correct. Helen Walker, not in her top four, should be based off of recent things, was also in the original Nightmare Alley as the Kate Blanchett role. Question two. The role that Nancy auditioned for was a Broadway musical that the role was initially only supposed to be five lines. But after Nancy wowed the director with her audition, he rewrote the script to give her a leading role, which caused her to be a breakout star. What was the musical? All of these musicals premiered on Broadway in 1941.
Okay.
A. Best Foot Forward. Just for fun, prep school student Bud Hooper writes a fan letter asking his idol, Hollywood actress Gail Joy, to come to Philadelphia to be his partner at the junior prom.
Otherwise known as the Mila Kunis story.
B. Lady in the Dark. Lisa Elliott finds herself constantly plagued by indecision in her professional and personal life. She is courted by two men, the already married publisher Kendall Nesbitt, who is trying to divorce his wife for Lisa, and her advertising manager Randy Curtis, and cannot decide who to choose. Or C, Let's Face It. Three suspicious wives, Maggie Watson, Nancy Collister, and Cornelia Pigeon, invite three Army inductees to Maggie's summer house in Southampton on Long Island in order to make their husbands jealous.
All right, based on the clue of a part that got bigger because of her audition, I don't think it can be B, which means it's going to be B. But I think it's probably one of the wives, or it's like the girlfriend of Bud Hooper. I'm going to go with A.
Correct. She does not play the Hollywood actress Gail Joy. She plays the unnamed blind date, who, despite not having a name, is throughout the play enlisted as being in three songs. I don't know if she's also in chorus or ensembles of others too, but in the credits of the play, she is named as one of the main singers in three of the, like, 10 songs. Question three. Nancy Walker is probably best known for her supporting role on a TV sitcom. Which past Muppet Show guest star was the star of that show? A. Florence Henderson. B. Sandy Duncan. Or C. Valerie Harper.
Valerie Harper.
That's correct. Nancy Walker played Valerie Harper's mother, Ida Morgenstern, on both The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Rhoda. Nancy Walker did appear on an episode of Hollywood Squares with both Florence Henderson and Sandy Duncan on December 16th, 1974.
Yeah, I'm sorry, dude. That was not actually knowing that. The voices are too similar. She's just so Rhoda-esque in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Question four. Nancy Walker was also a director. She directed episodes of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda, and Alice. She, however, only directed one feature film. Which band was featured in that movie? A. The Beach Boys. B. The Bee Gees. Or C. The Village People.
Bee Gees.
Incorrect. The Village People. She directed the 1980 film Can't Stop the Music, a pseudo-autobiography of the Village People. She was the first woman to direct a musical with a multi-million dollar budget.
Oh my gosh, this is also, How Did This Get Made? Superstar movie.
Yes, it also stars Caitlyn Jenner. It was a bomb, and she never directed another movie again. She had a multi-picture deal also to direct, but when this bombed so hard,
they scrapped it.
Yep, they scrapped it, and she never directed a movie again. She did, Alice was post this, so she did direct more, but never. Question five. Nancy Walker was also, and may be most famous for being a spokesperson for a very famous ad campaign. Which of the following ads was she in? A. Bounty, the quicker picker-upper. B. Charmin, don't squeeze the Charmin. Or C. Whisk as the ring around the collar housewife.
B.
Incorrect. She is Rosie the Waitress in Bounty ads from 1970 through 1990. 20 years of playing an ad campaign. I have a link to one of the ads, which I will send to you so you can do what you want.
So that I can share it with people who go to the episode pages.
Yes.
So Nancy Walker does not look young in this, and she's playing Rhoda's mom around this time. How old is Nancy Walker when she appears on this episode?
Nancy Walker was born in 1922, I believe.
That makes her 55.
Yeah.
Ish, depending on what time of year.
Yep. Certainly in her 50s.
Yep. So a little young, potentially, to be the mom of a 30-year-old, I'm assuming, that Rhoda Morgenstern is on Mary Tyler Moore and then spin off on her own. But she then did 20 years of being a waitress in ads after that?
Around the same time.
But starting around now. So going until she's 75, she's playing a waitress.
She passed away in 1992 of lung cancer. Mm. And like she basically stops working in the mid-80s, only doing sporadic things over there. She had lung cancer diagnosed in probably 83-ish and then beat it. And then it came back in 1991-ish. And then she passed away in 92. So, yeah, I also just looked it up. Valerie Harper was born in 1939. So it is 17 years difference, roughly.
Not the worst casting in the world.
Yeah. And I agree with you and I disagree with you.
In terms of how old Rhoda would have been on MTM and on Rhoda's show?
No, how old Nancy Walker looks. She doesn't look 55, I guess, now putting that math together. Mm. But she doesn't look young either. Like, I'm going to assume, I didn't read any about this in my research, she looks like a heavy smoker.
Okay, yeah. Well, she's talked about by Fozzie and mostly by Piggy as somebody that you've seen play a mom on lots of sitcoms. And so I think I'm basically saying that if characters on sitcoms are roughly 28 to 32, in the 70s. In the 60s, I think they were, wives particularly, were a fresh-faced 24. But at this time in the 70s, I feel like that 28 to 30 age range was about right in terms of where people were dealing with the professional and personal crises of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so add 20 to that, you're going to get maybe 25 to that, you're going to get somebody's mother's age. So to me, 55 clocks. I think she's just about perfect for that, in that she treads this middle ground. And when Piggy said, you've played a bunch of moms, and she has that amazing New York voice going on in the sketch earlier with Fozzie in the diner,
mm-hmm.
I was convinced, like, there's no way I haven't seen her.
She didn't do a lot of movies. She was definitely more of a TV actress.
Mm-hmm.
She was in, well, Mary Tyler Moore, according to Wikipedia, she was only in 4 episodes of.
Okay.
And she was in 42 episodes of Rhoda. But she, I couldn't figure out how to do a question about this, and I just remembered it, that there was a period of time where she was in the main cast of Macmillan and Wife and on Rhoda at the same time, because Macmillan and Wife ran from 71 to 76, and Rhoda ran from 74 to 78. And then she got her own show called The Nancy Walker Show in 76 that ran for 13 episodes.
I feel like a lot of Muppet guest stars are on the It's My Name show for 8 to 13 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this must have been the era of we're giving somebody a name recognition one season variety show.
Yeah. And so as I just said, Rhoda ran until 78 and her own named show ran from 76 to 77.
Hmm.
So she was just working.
Yeah.
All over the place. She also apparently really liked playing people named Nancy, because in the Nancy Walker show, she played someone named Nancy Kittredge.
Mm.
And in the show after the Nancy Walker show in 1977, Blansky's Beauties, she played Nancy Blansky for 13 episodes.
Well, I'll also say it's not uncommon for name recognition stars to play somebody with their own first name and a different last name.
Yeah.
Like, that's the veil of fiction that we drape over a lot of people. And so we get that fakeness of we're seeing the real them, even though their last name is different.
Yeah. It's also not uncommon to be liked by anyone.
Don't you twist that bit into new shapes.
I caught you not saying it.
It didn't even occur to me. It was just an accident.
And so I also didn't say it.
Totally appropriate comment to end about things that are not quite the same, but slightly different, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, well done.
Thank you.
Well, let's move swiftly on from that ridiculous thing and talk about the Nancy Walker sketches. But you think that we should talk about them in conjunction with the A story of the backstage antics as well.
Yeah, there's enough in there that cycles together that I think we should talk about that all as a junket.
Okay. So the premise of the backstage bits is that Kermit is not here. Despite being in the O that goes up in the entryway, he then immediately calls in sick because Fozzie comes out in front of the curtain talking to someone backstage, apparently Scooter, but then Scooter pops up behind him to tell him that Kermit said to just run with it, he'll know what to do. But the runner is that Fozzie doesn't know what to do. Fozzie has been watching this show for at least a season. We don't actually know how long The Muppet Show has been going before the first season, although there is an implication of an indeterminate amount of existence prior to the broadcast version of The Muppet Show. And yet he's still deeply unprepared to MC this.
Did you look at the fandom page about any of the notes about this episode? Because the biggest note is that Jim Henson had to leave the taping of this episode early. And that's why Kermit is not in it.
Well, I was wondering about that because we'll get to a sketch later where Rolf shows up. The fact that so much of the backstage stuff is just Frank and Dave interacting with each other and Kermit's legitimately not there until Jim showed up as Rolf, I was wondering, is this literally going to be a Jimless episode?
But Waldorf is also throughout the episode.
Mm-hmm.
But they could probably do those in a day.
That's my take, is that the Sattler and Waldorf are easy pickups.
Also, you mean Richard.
Yeah, I was thinking there are,
I mean, Gonzo and...
There are two major Gonzo interactions with Fozzie backstage. And yes, obviously, Richard and Frank do their stuff. But I don't know. To me, the Gonzo and Fozzie stuff popped.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. But that's... So this episode, because Jim left early, it threw the whole thing into a tailspin. And so the Fozzie storyline is basically them reacting in real time to what happened when Jim left. They're like, we don't know what to do without Jim, so we'll figure it out as we go too.
That's interesting. It's always dangerous to intuit improvisation, especially with something like The Muppet Show, where we've talked about how much the production needs of the show are they needed to get it absolutely technically right. And so even if something might have occurred to them in the moment, that there's still a good chance that they had to do it four or five times in order to get it right. And so that doesn't necessarily detract from the energy of spontaneity, but I also think it's always dangerous to be like, you guys were goofing around on set and just pointed the camera at it, right? I think that's a post-Will Ferrell interpretation of a lot of stuff.
Feel free to cut all of this.
Yeah.
On this week's episode of Doughboy's Double, they watched Muppet Treasure Island.
Hmm.
And in that, Nick has never seen a Muppet movie, despite working with Brian Henson on the Disney Plus show Earth to Net. And so Nick told a story about working with Brian where there were two takes that they could use. One had the better read and one had better mouth
sync.
And Brian says, you have to go with the mouth sync every single time. Because the minute that's off, which is what I've picked up on many, many times, it breaks the reality. So despite that being better and funnier, we got to go with the worst one.
Huh.
So going back to what you were just talking about with the improvisational stuff, yeah, I totally get that now after hearing that story. That they, who knows?
Regardless, I think some of the energy of we weren't planning on this seeps into the performance of Gonzo and Scooter and Fozzie and to a little bit Piggy and Rolf.
And I think also partially explains why some of the sketches or backstage segments feel kind of wheel spinny. Mm. Like they just repeat the things that we've already seen two or three times two or three times throughout the sketch. Like, they list the things that have gone wrong.
Oh, the opening number was sensational. Oh, those holes in the theater will be easy to fix. You should have seen the way he got the audience to come back after they started to leave.
In every backstage segment.
Got it. And you're saying it doesn't feel scripted in the same meticulous way.
Yeah. Okay. They're just like, oh. Yeah, you all remember when the lights went off and the audience went away and...
Interesting. I think that lent a greater naturalism to the performances. And in general, I, with the exception of one of the last backstage bits, I thought that the energy and the dialogue of the backstage bits was really good, and it really had me interested. Again, I was watching this for the first time, so I can't totally divorce that from just the joy of new Muppets, of the joy of discovery, but I also think that there was something going on there. And it's interesting, therefore, that as they may have just been saying things that really happened in their characters' voices, but without necessarily a script to refer to, that that helped make it less artificial because they weren't trying to do some of the jokey bits and therefore the awkward constructions of language in order to get you to a punchline.
Mm-hmm. I agree with all of that. However... there weren't a lot of punchlines in his backstage segments.
It's true.
Well, so let's start talking about things in detail.
Yeah, I was trying to move us in that direction.
So Scooter jumps in the dressing room, as he has done every episode so far, says 13 seconds to curtain. Stand by for curtain. Nancy says, stand by, I can't even stand up. And the camera goes out, and Timmy Monster is standing on her.
I don't recall having seen Timmy Monster before.
I had to look up to find what his name was.
There will be a monster later in the episode that I felt like was very familiar to me, and yet this was apparently his Muppet Show debut.
We talking Lunch Encounter Monster?
We are talking about Lunch Encounter Monster. Whereas this one, I couldn't place at all.
I've seen references to Lunch Encounter Monster. I think he may have shown up other places.
Well, because of the lack of things being in strict production order, I did go back and look at the Rich Little episode, and he's not one of the monsters that comes out of the stage door and grabs him. But there's a chance that he's been in something we have seen.
He's the monster who eats the coffee machine. Or not the coffee machine.
Yeah, the explosive thing that looks like a coffee machine. It looks like a hi-fi. Which was in which episode?
It was the George Burns episode.
Okay.
Also, the curtain gets cut to it 11 seconds in. So Scooter says 13 seconds. Close.
Closer than some of the ones that have been off before.
But early. I think they've always been late. Maybe not.
We'll have to ask our stats guy about that. He'll know.
He's not going to know.
Then they go to the opening. The opening has Statler and Waldorf rushing in to get to their seats, with Waldorf saying,
hurry up, they're starting!
Which feels wildly out of character.
Yeah, that they'd be excited for an episode.
And then the Gonzo bit is that as he blows into the trumpet, instead of a musical note, there's a gunshot. And then as he pulls it back to look quizzically at it, it goes off again in classic bad gun protocol.
Downrange.
Then Fozzie comes on, as I described, with Scooter coaching him from behind the curtain. Statler and Waldorf are scared of the fact that the frog has become sick, and they think that he really must be sick in order to have given Fozzie responsibility. And Fozzie is going to introduce Nancy Walker, but everything he does, Scooter has to feed him the line immediately before he does it, including up to telling him to get off stage. The next act, we will talk about later. And after that, we then have the fallout from that sketch wander by in the background of the backstage bit, with Fozzie anxiously fanning the characters with his hat and looking worried about what just went wrong.
But because we might talk about them, let's mention that the thing that goes wrong in that sketch is a cannon blows a hole in the theater. Because, as we talked about earlier, they're going to mention it like four more times.
That's true. So it comes up in conversation.
Yeah.
Scooter is at the phone telling Fozzie that Kermit's on the line. And this is one of a couple of different sequences where we have people having one-sided conversations with Kermit. And this is where I started to really wonder if Jim was actually absent, because they weren't cutting to Kermit in a sick bed. They weren't having a on the other side of the line.
Hi, yeah. The opening? Oh, great, yeah. Everybody got a big bang out of it.
They just had classic Bob Newhart button-down one-sided phone conversations.
Nancy Walker was on one episode of the Newhart Show. Or on Newhart.
And in this case, it's Kermit calling to ask for an update on how the show is going so far.
Which seems early.
Good point.
But he's not wrong. While he's on the phone with Kermit, reassuring him that everything's fine, Gonzo comes on stage and asks Fozzie what's going to be next. Fozzie asks what's on stage now. Gonzo says nothing. And then we find out that the audience is starting to leave.
Peter?
Yes.
This was such validation. In our long-running debate about things not happening on stage, to have a sketch written where nothing's happening on stage while stuff is going on backstage, and the audience is leaving. The audience can't see this. They can't see this conversation. There's no simulcast. They're not the TV audience. There are no takes to camera in this episode at all. I felt vindicated.
Ben, as our listener Sarah has mentioned to me before, whatever suits the show is the reality.
That's right. There is no continuity between episodes except when they need it to be. And otherwise, each episode establishes its own rules.
However, I don't disagree with you. And this just leads credence to my theory that there's sketches that we don't see that are on stage.
Mm-hmm. I believe that that's true.
Because no audience would show up for 5 minutes of entertainment.
So true. Well, let me actually qualify that. I think the Muppet Show audience does show up for 5 minutes of entertainment in a 30-minute show. And they're lucky to get those 5 minutes. Fozzie rushes back out. You have a shot of the audience departing and then moving back towards their seats, at which point he says, it's guest star time.
And he goes to introduce her, but forgets her name after saying the incredibly talented, unforgettable, and then forgetting her name.
Statler and Waldorf shout out her name to remind him in an insert shot, and then you have Fozzie also forgetting not just the guest star's name, but that he's in the sketch that's about to start. And so he asks Scooter to fill while he can get into his costume, and Scooter attempts to sell the audience subscriptions to what sounds like a combination of Horse and Hound and Field and Stream.
Listen, I'm selling magazine subscriptions to win a skateboard at school, and I was wondering if I could interest anybody out there in 72 issues of Field and Farmer.
And he's also selling them a wild number. It's like 72 issues.
That's right. Well, that is a 6-year subscription.
Okay.
In order to be able to buy a skateboard.
1977. Those kids already want skateboards. Skateboarding doesn't really hit until the 80s.
It is a great thing about how young Scooter is. Like, that's a great detail. He's selling magazines for school to buy a skateboard. They have just pumped an enormous amount of youth character tags on the Scooter in this.
And is also the highest paid member of the crew.
I had a very clear memory of Scooter riding a skateboard in the Muppet collectible trading card set.
Hmm. Yes.
In the character cards. I was wrong.
Hmm.
There were ads in comic books and magazines for the cards that had Gonzo, Kermit, and Animal on skateboards, but the photo of Scooter in the set doesn't have him on a skateboard. However, there were two figurines, an action figure from the 90s and a...
Please say Lego minifig. Please say Lego minifig.
No. And a statue, like the I brought out the Snouth and the Menomina PVC figurines from Palisades.
Mm-hmm.
They don't move. They're not, therefore, action figures. that figure of Scooter has him riding a skateboard. So somebody, when they were looking for things to do, went back and watched this episode and said, Scooter's a skateboarding youth.
So once Fozzie changes his costume, he's ready for the sketch, and the sketch is revealed that they're at a diner. And Nancy's a customer at the diner counter, Fozzie is the waiter, and the luncheon counter monster, as we previously mentioned, is sitting next to her.
Named because he's in the luncheon counter sketch. His body language is that he has one elbow on the counter, sort of half blocking himself from what's going on. He's always trying to be in the scene, but also looking away. And most of the interaction, therefore, happens between Fozzie wearing his paper hat behind the lunch counter and Nancy as a customer at the lunch counter. Except that this studied nonchalance, it's because, not because he's ordering things with bread, but because he is stealing whatever is offered to Nancy Walker and eating it.
They catch on that something's going on. They don't know that it's him. And they get a whole platter of glassware given to them by the cook, the Swedish chef. And they put that down in front of him, and
then they each make a terrible excuse for why they can't be standing at the counter for a moment.
Yeah, the equivalent of, like, a kid being in a room being like, I'm gonna walk away now! Stomp, 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 stomp. And then the turn is that Nancy wants some too, and she takes a big bite out of a glass.
That, yeah, she's less annoyed that her scarf has been pulled off her neck and eaten, but that he has been hogging all the glassware to himself.
And then she rips a piece of the counter off and takes a big bite of that, too. So it's not just glassware that she wants.
Right.
She's just hungry.
To which Statler and Waldorf basically say, you wouldn't like me when I'm hangry, by saying that she's a great actress, but they wouldn't want to take her out to dinner.
The next bit is another piece of the backstage runner. Now Gonzo's on the phone with Kermit and telling Kermit in a very positive, enthusiastic way everything that's gone wrong in the show. Again, recounting, the audience is gone, there's a hole in the wall.
Interestingly to me, it's one of the few moments in the show where there isn't back and forth. Like, almost nobody has large portions of uninterrupted dialogue, except here with Gonzo, where he gets like 3.5 sentences with nobody interrupting in order to turn it into dialogue. So it may be a recap, but it's also an interesting escalation of Gonzo's personality in that he thinks that the fact that everything's teetering on disaster is fantastic.
Yeah, where season one Gonzo would have been down in the dumps, just dour about the whole show being bad.
Mm-hmm. But instead, Gonzo's just like, yeah, everything's broken and it's great.
Yeah. Fozzie eventually wrestles the phone away from Gonzo. And calls for At the Dance to be next as he starts to tell Kermit.
Well, no, he says that Vets Hospital is next and then rushes off stage and leaving the phone unattended for Piggy to come on in her Vets Hospital costume.
No, he says At the Dance is next.
Does because, he?
Yes.
All right, At the Dance, everybody. Hi, Kermit. Listen, I got to make an introduction. I'll be right back.
Okay, I missed the part, and this is fine, that he said, I'm going to go set up At the Dance. I thought that the revelation that he was setting up At the Dance came from Rolf when he wanders on stage telling Piggy, hey, we were supposed to do Vets Hospital, but
Fozzie just introduced At the Dance.
At the Dance?
Mm-hmm.
I promised Kermit the hospital sketch.
And that is what we're going to do.
But what a great premise is that now they're doing Vets Hospital, even though the theme song for the taxi dance of At the Dance is going on and there are two couples dancing around them.
We've got the Vets Hospital set, but two chandeliers on either side instead of the single
lighting fixture that goes over the operating table.
And yes, I believe there are two couples already dancing. And then the Vets Hospital cast comes in through those double doors.
Instead of having Piggy be involved with something because she's rushing on stage, so she doesn't have a prop to be working on, is that she is smacked from behind by one of the swinging double doors that she rushes through, and then its momentum carries it back around to whang her from behind.
Does that count as a hit?
I think so.
Okay.
We haven't generally attributed inanimate objects as having a hit, but I like it.
Okay. I didn't realize until this sketch that At the Dance and Vets Hospital are the same sketch.
It's just that, as we said, it took until basically the end of season one for the jokes in At the Dance to be on a theme
mm-hmm.
instead of being scattershot. At the Dance has always been the joke wall from Laugh-In,
yeah.
or At the Party from Laugh-In, where they just do whatever and they don't need to be connected. Whereas Vets Hospital picks usually the thing that's on the operating table and then does a bunch of puns on that. And so the bunch of puns is the dancing.
Yep.
We never even get a real clear shot of what's on the operating table.
Yeah, I was going
or
to
a
do
reference to what it is.
Animal Watch, and the answer is I don't know.
It's blue?
It's blue, and it does look like it has hair. I think it's a person, quote unquote.
It's a Muppet.
Yeah, it's a Muppet, but it's not an animal Muppet or a monster. So I'm going to go with officially not an animal. But yeah, it's amazing how just the set dressing and presentation can hide the fact that it's the same sketch. It's the same premise. And going back to what you said earlier about them just making jokes about dancing, I don't think they do that.
Mm.
The dancers are making jokes about the hospital,
That's
and the
right.
hospital is making jokes about dancing.
So they're each doing their bit, which is... The Vets Hospital is talking about what's wrong with the operating table, which is that there are dancers there. But the dancers are doing exactly what would be a late season At the Dance is, well, something happened on the dance floor and we're now all going to comment on it. And what happened on the dance floor is there are these doctors here.
I read it more as they were, going back to the improvisational idea behind this episode, that they were improvising, quote unquote, these jokes to undercut the other sketch that wasn't supposed to be at the moment.
They're each trying to steal valor from the other sketch.
Yeah, the dancers are like, no, this is our sketch. You're the B sketch. And Vets Hospital is saying, no, this is our set.
You're the setting that we make our jokes about because we're supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
Eventually, the announcer voice does come on. Only Janice looks for the voice.
Mm.
Everyone else is preoccupied with whatever else they're doing. And then the left chandelier falls on Piggy. Ben, is that a hit?
Well, if the door's a hit, I think the chandelier has to be a hit. If we hadn't counted the door, I would have probably left it up to you.
I only have questionable hits this episode. So I will check with you every time there's a hit.
Okay.
So far, we're at two. After this, we go back to backstage.
Mm-hmm. There's an insert shot of Fozzie opening the door to the operating theater and looking at the disastrous mixture of these two sketches.
Mm.
And then it cuts to backstage of him talking with Scooter saying, I can't believe it, the whole show is falling apart.
Things can't possibly get worse, he thinks. But then Scooter tells him that the crew is threatening to walk out, the stagehand, the prop man, the lighting man. Fozzie isn't sure who he should talk to first. And as he's saying this, all the lights go out. And so Scooter suggests maybe try the lighting guy.
The lighting guy whose name is?
Harvey!
I don't know why that detail delighted me, but I was like, I'm making a point of talking about Harvey. It's a good name to shout.
Yeah. And he's also a wonderful hamster.
After the lights have gone to everything being a middle gray, it then also fades to black after that because it's the ad break.
Yep. And Fozzie also trips as he's chasing after Harvey.
I liked the idea of going to dark is a presage to fading to black.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that too. That was a good call.
As they come back from ad break, they go into the UK spot, which we will talk about later.
After that is another, quote, musical number, which also doesn't have anything to do with Nancy or the runner, so we'll also return to that.
I think we'll probably spend a lot of time on that.
Yep.
But finally, we get to a dressing room sketch where Fozzie comes in to check in with Nancy Walker because he's worried that the show has been a little shaky and wants to make sure that the guest star is being taken care of.
Once again, reiterating all of the things that have already gone wrong.
As for the sketches being done at the same time, yeah. Do you know how many times I've seen that done?
How many?
Never.
So Nancy ends up reassuring him by singing a song called Pick Yourself Up, which works until she reminds him that it's just a song.
Thank you, Miss Walker. I feel terrific now.
Well, I'm glad you're happy.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's just a song. This show's in a lot of trouble.
I thought that despite the fact that this was, as you say, a decent amount of repetition, and the song itself is given kind of short shrift. They basically do maybe four lines from the song in the middle of what's going on.
The song is 49 seconds.
The funniest bit is her interactions and her little digs at Fozzie. As Fozzie is trying to do the right thing of being a stage manager and reassuring her that everything's fine, she is not giving him any cover. She's pretending to not know who she is because he forgot her name. She's putting in little digs, and he is gasping and crying and generally making himself into the victim.
Hey, Ben. I have another segment for you.
Yeah.
The segment that I don't think has been in season two yet, but the Give Pete 45 years, he'll punch anything up segment.
We haven't officially done Pete punching anything up. I had a little chance to say, here's how I might have fixed this. But we didn't use the theme song.
I don't have a way to punch this up, but I do have a suggestion for this episode.
Okay.
Which is, Fozzie has a catchphrase, which as of yet has not appeared in The Muppet Show.
Walker, Walker, Walker?
This should have been especially because he couldn't remember her name. So he should have just been repeating it over and over and over again, and it turns into Walker, 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 which eventually gets a laugh from the audience, and therefore...
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you would have had to be a time traveler to make that work, because I don't think they had a plan for Waka 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 to be a thing.
Hiya, hiya, hiya!
We'll have to pay attention to when it finally shows up.
It was just a thought I had, and...
I had the same thought when you were doing your trivia question about three women named Walker. I almost made the dumb joke.
Walker, Walker, Walker!
So, I'm there with you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, since time traveling isn't an option, because despite wife guys being all the rage right now, I am not a time traveler's wife. One last note about the sketch. It has the weirdest non-kiss kiss I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Because in reassuring Fozzie, she gives him a quick peck on the nose, except she kind of inverts her lips and then puts them to Fozzie's nose. It's weird. And I didn't like it. But it's a Muppet human kiss.
It is.
So I logged it.
Wild speculation.
Love it.
This is not the first take. And Fozzie doesn't taste very good.
Fair.
And so she is removing the parts of the lip prior to going in for contact. That there might be some lingering fur.
And because the sink was better on this one, they had to use it.
After Nancy Walker's total lack of support and or reassurance to Fozzie, we have a Sam the Eagle bit, a Statler and Waldorf bit, and then...
back to the dressing room.
For Piggy to come in on the totally ridiculous premise of, can I use your hairbrush?
And this is where she then talks about how motherly Nancy Walker is.
Because I let you use my hairbrush, big deal.
No, because of those parts you play on television. I just knew you'd be an overly considerate, protective, mother-type person.
Which was not the motherly vibe I was getting from Nancy Walker. So I was in... I think that's one of the reasons the line stood out to me so much is... she really felt like Rhoda Morgenstern's mom. She felt like somebody that would be critical, that would be overbearing.
Yeah, because up until this point, we've seen her in the diner sketch where she was a secret monster herself. And then her not reassure Fozzie.
That's
just
right.
Now. That's it.
And the idea of Piggy saying, I knew you'd be nice, was a swerve. Compared to what she'd exhibited on the show so far.
for you, who yes. had no prior no knowledge of their prior knowledge.
Yeah.
And I'm on board there, too, because I also had no idea who this woman was.
But the purpose of calling her nice is to set up the next action, is that she takes a phone call, Kermit's on the line checking in, and she does, in fact, go into mom mode by making sure that he's fine, asking him about how sick he is, pledging to bring over some chicken soup.
Because as the phone rang, Nancy was starting to correct Piggy, which is why that swerve then happens.
Yep. She instantly transforms into somebody who is caring, maybe to the point of overbearing,
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out with what he is ill.
Kermit reveals to her, and she reveals to Piggy, that Kermit is sick with swine flu, which sets Piggy off. And she hi-yahs the phone. Ben, does that count as a hit?
I was going to ask you, because it was interesting that she doesn't attack Nancy.
She attacks the phone.
She's effectively, by the transitive order of properties, attacking Kermit.
Although Piggy has attacked many a messenger beforehand.
Uh-huh.
So it's not a...
It wasn't beyond the realm of possibility that she would have attacked Nancy for being the bearer of bad news.
But I think because she was holding the thing that was delivering the news, that thing could be hit. Where if Nancy had walked in and said, Kermit told me you had swine flu, Nancy would have got hit. If she had just swiped the phone off the table, I don't know if I would have counted it. But because she hi-yahs the phone, it counts as a hit.
Okay.
We cut from the dressing room to backstage. This is what I was getting at earlier when I was like, oh, it goes backstage. I was remembering this part of the show.
Yep.
And after this, well, the next part is an introduction. So that is on stage, but it's still a lot of backstage in a row.
Yeah, and Scooter's saying, Fozzie, it's time to introduce Nancy Walker's musical number. Nancy didn't especially seem like she was about ready to go out on stage. Is she wearing the coat and tails that she's...
I just looked at the screenshot on Fandom, and no, she is not.
But when Piggy comes in, there's no energy from Nancy of, hey, Pig, I'm trying to get ready for my number. She's very cash.
She's doing her makeup.
She is. But she doesn't feel like this is going to be a thing that's going to prevent me from being ready.
Yeah. Fozzie's backstage looking forlorn. Scooter enters and tells him it's time to introduce the number, like you said. Fozzie is too ashamed to go back out there. Scooter gives him a letter from Nancy Walker that's encouraging.
Yeah, I just want to tell you what a pleasure it was to work with you on your show. You're really terrific. The frog's been holding you back.
He's all jazzed up, ready to go. He leaves the letter for Scooter to read, but Scooter tells us, the audience, so there is a camera take.
Oh, you're right.
That he doesn't need to because he wrote it. Now, I have another quibble.
Okay.
Which is, only a few episodes ago, we had Scooter writing letters. And now we have...
Just last episode. It's the Dom DeLuise.
Yes, it is. I couldn't remember. So yeah, episodes back to back, Scooter writing letter jokes. They weren't production ordered
no,
the
they
same,
were not.
Same order. But still, it's too soon. It's still a good joke. And I wonder if this is where they got the idea for later.
The idea of Scooter being a person that would write fake letters could have percolated out of this.
Yeah. Because here it's sort of a toss-off, where there it is a plot point.
I mentioned that Nancy was going to be in a coat and tails because there... Well, I should talk about the fairly extended curtain bit before we get to that. Because
yes.
It is a fairly extended curtain bit. In that, as Fozzie rushes out on stage to introduce the number in front of the curtain, Gonzo comes out in what Gonzo seems to think would be helpful support in saying, don't forget her name again this time. And Fozzie is very insistent that he's not going to. But then Gonzo decides to come up with a mnemonic for what her name isn't. That if you were confused, here are some rhyming words that you shouldn't say instead.
That's Nancy. Rhymes with fancy.
I know.
Walker rhymes with talker.
Gonzo, I have it.
And it's Nancy Walker, not fancy talker.
It's not really a mnemonic. It's not really Cockney rhyming slang. It's like a combo of those two things.
And Fozzie gets so frustrated that Gonzo is trying to be helpful, but also is being distracting by creating alternate ways in which he could forget her name. he just says, look, I'm not going to forget to say Nancy Walker, all right? And then storms off stage.
Forgetting to introduce Nancy Walker. He did not forget her name.
Correct.
This was another opportunity for Waka Waka Waka, because he says Nancy Walker repeatedly over and over again in a short period of time. So naturally, could have just said, I'm not going to forget Walker, Waka, Waka, Waka. And then the crowd could have gone wild. 45 years.
Yeah, but also temporal pincer movement of needing whenever that phrase to exist to have now been added into the show before.
No, I'm saying this is the birth of that.
Okay. But then the crowd wouldn't have gone wild.
Well, they would have laughed at it. They would have gone...
I think it has to be a callback in order for it to be funny.
No, because I think they laugh at the surprise or like the silliness of saying Walker and then it turning into that and getting her name wrong all these other times. And then they would have laughed and Fozzie would have been like, that got a laugh! I'm going to use this as a catchphrase.
That's good for first season Fozzie, who was always trying to get a laugh. He hasn't really been doing that. With the exception of the ventriloquist dummy, we haven't seen Fozzie desperate for material yet this season.
Mm-hmm. But he still loves a laugh.
Of course he loves a
laugh.
He's
a comedian.
That's
right. He's desperate for it.
But having then... being told by Gonzo that he forgot to introduce her in the first place and giving a wonderful yell. A wonderful arg, a Charlie Brown-esque arg, chases Gonzo off stage, and we then have the curtains part to Sweetums and Nancy in a tux and a top hat doing You Can't Take That Away From Me, which is a George and Ira Gershwin number that first appeared in the Fred Astaire film Shall We Dance in 1937. And I think I'm most familiar with it by when it was covered by Billie Holiday and Count Basie that same year. But there's a very famous Ella Fitzgerald Louis Armstrong version from 56 and a quite good Stacey Kent version from like 2000-ish. You like Sweetums.
I do like Sweetums.
Nancy and Sweetums kind of singing and beating up on each other.
I clearly didn't remember that there were hits in this. Yeah. When I said earlier, there might not have been any hits in this episode because there's three hits in this. She hits him with her top hat and then later elbows and kicks him. Or it's like a 1-2 punch that she does to Sweetums. This is where you can tell she used to be on Broadway because she's an incredible dancer.
Yep.
She's so light on her feet.
I even spent a little bit of time wondering if that was Richard Hunt in the outfit, because he's doing a good job matching her. Compared to some of the stuff that he's done previously, like he wasn't quite that agile when he danced with Ruth Buzzy, for example.
Mm-hmm. I don't have any numbers.
Okay.
And as the numbers guy, this upsets me. But Nancy is... a very tiny lady.
Yeah.
I don't have her height anywhere.
Okay.
But I feel like she's sub 5 feet. I think she's like 4'11".
I'd be surprised.
Because there were lots and lots of references to... Let me Google.
How dare you.
4'11".
Nailed it. I'm shocked. I wouldn't have assumed she was less than 5'2".
So yeah, I mentioned that because there were references to... In my research or in this episode kind of like... the Muppets aren't that much smaller than her.
Okay.
Which makes the Sweetums difference between the two of them that much bigger.
So I was asking how you felt about this song, because while we'll get back to it later, there are two great jazz numbers in this, and this is one of the two of them. I therefore had a degree of affection for this episode in part just because of the songs that we've picked. The two previous vocal numbers, the four lines of the bit with Fozzie and the UK spot, which we'll talk about soon. Those songs aren't particularly memorable, but this is a great song to me. And so I was wondering whether or not the vibe of the dancing, the vibe of the violence helped you go, yeah, I like this, even if you didn't like the song or if the song appealed to you.
We'll get into this later.
Okay.
But I'll just say, And this may partially be because I don't have a memory. I placed this episode before rewatching it. And I placed it so much lower initially because I basically didn't remember a single thing Nancy Walker did in it.
Huh.
And then on rewatching it, I was like, oh, this is way better than I didn't remember.
Let's definitely get into it later because I would have been shocked if you were saying there weren't good human Muppet interactions in this. It's just that they're not showy in the same way.
Yeah. So I really liked this.
Okay.
I really liked
this. Once you remembered
it. Yes.
Good. I'm glad that your Sweetums love...
carried through. And it was... I love Sweetums.
Yeah.
But Sweetums was not the reason I loved this. Nancy Walker is fantastic in this sketch. Number. Sketch number.
You're a numbers guy.
I am a numbers guy.
I would hope you would like this. Then we have the curtain, and finally Kermit joins them, wearing a hospital gown?
Yeah, I was... and
with an ice bag on his head.
Or a hot water bag. I never know which one it... It can be both, right?
It's not a hot water bottle. Those True. Are those rubber things. Yeah. So I've always assumed that they just contain ice.
Fair. But Kermit... comes up because Fozzie starts introducing it and apologizing for the show again, mm-hmm. saying Kermit is probably going to fire him. And then Kermit enters and does in fact fire him.
Nancy says, "Don't worry, Kermit. I had a wonderful time working with what's-his-name the bear," which is both a good continuation of her pretending not to know who she was in the backstage bit earlier, but also... good revenge on Fozzie.
Mm-hmm. Before she comes out, Kermit says he wants to give her one good introduction mm-hmm. because everything he's heard this episode, she hasn't gotten a single good introduction. So he brings her out by saying, "Nancy," and then sneezes during her name.
Fozzie is very joyful about being, even you can't give her a good introduction.
Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause for Miss Nancy.
You blew it too. It's Nancy Walker.
And then as he's signing off on the show, saying his typical sign off, "We'll see you next time on The Muppet Sneeze." So yeah, Kermit's sick.
Yeah. Kermit should not be there. And he should be wearing a mask.
Absolutely. It was a different time, Ben.
Yeah, it's true.
But yes, he should be wearing a mask. It's putting everyone in danger.
That ice bag is not protecting people.
The credits roll. Then we have Statler and Waldorf. Waldorf says, "Wonderful, I loved it."
Mm-hmm.
Statler asks who his favorite was. And Waldorf says, "Who else? The frog." And Statler just goes, Is it because Kermit's not in this episode?
Oh, that's a better guess than I thought. I assumed it was Inside Baseball that Jim Henson...
is also Waldorf, yeah.
Is therefore... And I thought, I was like, what a weird joke to end the episode on... that most people who don't necessarily follow who's the puppeteer will know. And so Statler's long-suffering gaze at that, being like, that's a joke, was appropriate if that's why they decided to go with that.
I think it's both.
Okay.
I think they meant it in the way of the frog was barely in the episode, so therefore that's his favorite because it's the smallest part of the episode. But I bet when they came up with that idea, they went, oh, it's also very funny that
because
you're saying
the meta.
Yeah.
I wish that your interpretation had either occurred to me or been more clear so that it would have occurred to me.
Yeah. Statler just going, definitely is weird.
Didn't help underscore it.
Yeah. So all right. We've reached the end of the episode, but we glossed over some things. So let's return to the beginning.
Do we need to go through, because so much of the episode we've already covered, do we need to go bit by bit through everything we've already said?
No, I'd say let's just, the first sketch of the night is the night train sketch, which happens as the first sketch right after Fozzie introduces it.
That's a good way to do it.
Which is a musical-only number. There's some gibberish talk in it, but it is a musical number of Crazy Harry and a bunch of Whatnot soldiers doing target practice with a cannon,
mm-hmm.
and they keep blowing things up that they aren't supposed to be blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
the gibberish, it only occurred to me the second time. My first round notes were, these are Civil War soldiers, which I think makes sense with both their uniforms, the fact that he's using a sword to point, a cavalry saber, to point to where he wants them to shoot, and that they're shooting cannons. All of that tracks.
Until.
Well, yeah, I wasn't even thinking about the plane. Until I thought about the gibberish. And I was like, why aren't they having him say anything? And then it occurred to me, I wondered if this was supposed to be added funny in a Swedish Chef mode, that they were the fictional country from Duck Soup or something like that. You know, is this supposed to be an homage to a fake European nation? And so this was now, but they weren't good soldiers yet. I wasn't sure where, how that landed.
I didn't even think about that part of it. I took it as dialogue was unnecessary.
Mm.
Similar to like the Kuzbanians or so many other Muppets that are vocal but not verbal.
Mm.
Any dialogue or lines wouldn't have added anything to the sketch. As a matter of fact, it might have taken it away from it.
The one particular extended moment of the general being like, here, it's here, you're supposed to be being here, was the one that took me out of it. If they had just done that with, it never even would have occurred to me. But because they have that long, unbroken shot of him doing gibberish for the equivalent of three sentences, I suddenly thought, is this supposed to be commentary on a thing? Night Train, by the way, is written by Jimmy Forrest in 1951 and was originally just an instrumental piece. It has been given lyrics to it on occasion. There was a James Brown performance of it that Wikipedia was in love with, but I think your father's sister's love of Oscar Peterson is probably where we would be more in love with it, because Night Train is the title of one of the Oscar Peterson Trio's albums. However, why I was humming along with this song is because it's playing in the background while George McFly is cutting a rug at the Enchantment Under the Sea dance.
Okay. Yep. Sure is. I also knew I knew this, but could not place it.
Yep. That bam ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum with the horns is because of Marvin and the Starlighters.
About Night Train.
Yeah.
The credits. Only Whatnot Commander is credited.
Mm.
Crazy Harry isn't listed as a performer in the like by performer breakdown.
Yep.
So I have no idea who was playing who.
Who was the commander?
Jerry Nelson.
Who is normally Crazy Harry.
So,
but of course they never appear in the same shot.
That's true. So in the improvisational aspect of this episode, this may have been an idea that they had, but maybe wasn't fully formed. They were like, well, Jim's not here, we'll do this.
It is interesting that Jerry Nelson plays the lead action-oriented character in both sides of the shot. And that everybody else is just a background artist. Mm-hmm. They're firing the camera or they're running and hiding from things, but they don't have anything vocal to do. And so it does make it seem like that could have been done with a pre-credit Louise Gold or somebody like that. So that it was kind of a pickup sketch because we don't have the major players.
Regardless, lots of fun, very catchy, 14 explosions.
Oh my gosh, yes, of course. So while you didn't remember three hits and weren't sure about three hits and therefore thought this was going to be a low hit episode, it has more than made up for it right from the get-go in terms of explosions.
Yeah, because I counted every cannon blast as an explosion.
And every landing.
Yes. And as we referenced earlier, this sketch ends by the cannon shooting a cannonball off stage and through the theater wall.
They're laughing so hard at the fact that they have nearly destroyed the people they're supposed to be on their side that they knock the cannon to the side, and even Crazy Harry, who usually seems to revel in explosions, looks shaken and disturbed by the fact that they have blown a hole in the side of the Muppet Theater.
which Statler and Waldorf then comment on, Statler saying, for once we got a blast out of something on this show. And Waldorf was cowering.
Went down below the lip of the box so much that he was scared, and comes up with a green army helmet that he has just stashed there beneath his seat.
And asks, but how do you dig a foxhole in a theater box?
Well, apparently he's done it previously and bivouacked lots of supplies there. The next major segment after that
is the UK spot,
which is Rolf at the piano and an old man coming out and singing a song that is apparently called Dear Old Dutch.
My Old Dutch.
Okay. Was written in 1892 and sung by Pete Albert Chevalier.
Oh, the owner of the theater in Medford, Massachusetts?
Entirely possible the person that this theater was named after, because he was a legendary music hall performer. And there's a chance that the Chevalier Theater would have been created as an homage.
Even though it's essentially a high school gym.
This is, as I say, a music hall song, and it's performed as such. We've talked a lot about music hall songs so far this season. There is a UK-only EP, never released in the US, that has four music hall songs in it. So far, Don't Dilly Dally on the Way, Watcher Knocked Him on the Old Silk Road, it's not Silk, Old Something Road, and Up in the Gallery. The fourth song is not this one. Do you want to know when it shows up in the season?
This time, yes.
John Cleese, episode 23.
Okay.
So, there was something about this that they thought was not so saleable, and I think it's because the John Cleese music hall song features Piggy.
Mm.
And Watcher Knocked Him on the Old Road is Fozzie. Piggy is...
No Fozzie.
Is Don't... Piggy is Don't Dilly Dally and Boy Up in the Gallery.
I was talking about this song. Sorry. Yep. My bad.
So I think those were Muppets that were saleable on a album, whereas this poor, unfortunate old British man, as voiced by Jerry Nelson, is just not sexy enough to headline one of four songs on an EP.
You're saying Burlington Birdie isn't worthy?
Is not Burlington worthy, so no.
We've been together now for 40 years, and it don't seem a day too much.
Statler and Waldorf, in typical music hall fashion, do join in tearfully, but joyously. Like, they're sad tears, or they're...
sympathetic tears.
Yes. Boring song. Didn't deserve to be on the EP.
Weirdly enough, this song is on the closing track on a dual LP, the second release by Herman's Hermits.
Huh.
So they thought that this song was good enough to go out on a long play follow-up album from 1966. And they sort of made their career in part by doing covers and doing songs that harken back to the past. You know what one of their singles was from their first album?
I do not know.
I'm Henry VIII, I
am. Oh. Is that the version of the song we all know?
Probably.
Mm.
They must have had a very strange career, but part of it was, in the folk explosion, they were doing funny, weird covers of things that weren't really the kind of thing that would be radio popular, but doing it with overlapping male harmonies in order to make it of the era.
Hmm.
And, this song is on their second album. It is more enjoyable in the Herman Hermits arrangement, but otherwise it's still a song about an old man saying how much he still loves his wife after 40 years.
Hey, wife guys are all the rage right now. After the UK spot, we have Sully Sullenberger's least favorite sketch of all time.
Are you saying this sketch is for the birds, Pete?
Yeah. A man sits in his living room reading while a bird in a cage tweets.
He's got his smartphone out and he's commenting 280 characters at a time.
And then more birds come in because of those tweets that he's tweeting.
He's an influencer.
Each tweeting their own individual tweet. And when you combine all the tweets together, it forms a thread or a tweet storm.
Mm. Yeah, so it's an additive process because we have a canary in a cage, a fluff ball of a canary, and then various birds, about half of which have come from the old sex and violence sketch. Where there were a number of birds chanting hipster phrases in a tree. It's a courting ritual. And they're joined by a duck, a chicken, and a couple of birds that weren't from that initial sketch way back when. I really thought this was going to be that they were building the background to a song. That together, all of their individual noises would form the backing track, and then either the canary or the guy reading a book would then burst into "I can't stop this feeling" or something. Like, it had that kind of rhythm and quality to it. My brain the whole time was like, what is this song? I can almost recognize it.
No, you can't.
Because that's not the point of the sketch.
If it wasn't for the ending, which we are about to talk about,
mm-hmm.
I would have liked the original version, sex and violence version, better.
Yep.
I liked the set dressing of this sketch more. It was more interesting to look at. But I liked the hipster phrases turning that into a song more than I just liked birds doing their calls.
But the turn in this is that the guy is delighted that his canary in a cage's song has brought this strange menagerie of other fowl to his window, and they each have their own individual call, and they've created this additive experience of their voices all combining together into a strange chorus, a strange rhythmic pattern. But it turns out that they are
Voltroning their calls together.
That it forms a bat signal of sorts, and a giant chicken bursts through the wall, Kool-Aid Man style, to grab the man out of his chair, stuff him in the bird cage, and put the canary in the armchair in his place.
It's a good ending. And it's the same giant chicken suit from the Harvey Korman episode.
Correct, but this was first. And so that giant chicken suit was reused in the Harvey Korman series. Wait, hang on.
No, Harvey Korman was last season.
No, it's not the same giant chicken outfit from the Harvey Korman episode, because Harvey Korman's face was in a chicken suit peeking out from the bill. This is a complete puppet head with no human features.
Well, according to the Wikia, it's the same suit.
What this is the same suit as the chicken that busts into Statler and Waldorf's booth once they're criticizing all the chickens for laying an egg in the audience. And that's what I thought you were saying. I was so ready for you to say that fact that I didn't even bother listening to what you were actually saying.
No, but according to the Wikia, it is the same chicken suit from Harvey Korman.
It may have been the same body, but it's definitely a different head.
Well, it wasn't the same body because that body was Harvey Korman's, and this was not Harvey Korman in that suit.
It may have been the same outer wrapping. I would have to look at the weird waddly feathers that are on the wings of this particularly violent giant chicken that has threatened both the bookworm and Statler and Waldorf, and see if that's what Harvey Korman's arms look like when he's been transformed into a chicken way back when. But I will say that also on fandom, the birds that were in the hipster bird sketch all have names. They, if you go to the birds entry that lists all of the birds that have showed up in various Muppet Enterprises, they have names like Floyd and Clyde, and Shirley are from the bird sketch in Sex and Violence, is what I have written down in the margins here. None of those birds had those names in that sketch. Because the entry on that sketch links to a sketch, a drawing that Henson made of the concepts of those birds, line drawings of the birds with the phrases that they say underneath them. And they're just labeled bird number one, bird number four. So those names being added is 100% post hoc editing.
Nice.
Or in the chicken's case, post-Bach editing.
Even more nice. I'm on board for that one. I usually don't like your puns. This one I'm on board for.
I think the audio evidence, perhaps due to judicious editing, would indicate otherwise.
I believe the last thing we have to talk about is Sam the Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
Sam enters. Is he standing in behind a podium?
He is standing behind a lectern.
Lectern.
In front of a seal that's meant to look like the presidential seal, except it's a Sam the Eagle, therefore underscoring the American part of Sam the American Eagle. This is the second of Sam's soliloquies. The previous iteration that this set was constructed for was in the previous production episode with Judy Collins.
Mm.
And so the first Sam monologue will occur there, and this is the second iteration. But because this one is on the album, this is the only part of this episode I knew.
Which, as we alluded to earlier, something was cut from this episode from Nickelodeon.
Oh!
Unsurprisingly, because it's about nudity, this never aired on Nickelodeon.
I would just like to say a few words about nudity.
He wants everyone to think about how everyone is naked under their clothes.
Well, it just starts off by saying that there's so much nudity in the world today, which I think most people would assume isn't true. But then the bit is that underneath their clothes, people are walking around naked.
But it's not just people, it's animals too.
Little puppies and kittens can't be trusted, he says. Underneath their fur, naked.
And birds. Birds too. And as he says this, he realizes that he's a bird, and so therefore he too is naked under his feathers, and becomes embarrassed, and he covers himself up, and gets off stage. For the second time this episode,
yeah,
they do a bit. Oh, rewind.
Yeah.
Because I just remember in my notes, I have a very good joke.
Okay.
When Sam realizes that he's naked and he slides off stage, it's basically the same joke from a couple weeks ago. It's a better and more fleshed out joke than the Muppet Newsflash from a couple weeks ago.
It is. It is effectively the Muppet Newsflash, which was in which episode?
I don't know that, Ben. Listen, you're lucky I remembered that that happened. To then ask me the detail of which episode? I watch one of these a week. You cannot expect me to remember.
Here's what I could have expected of you, and clearly did, is that since, and I'm going to have to cut this sentence, you rewound in order to tell a prepared joke. This didn't just occur to you. Therefore, it might have occurred to you to be like, when was that bit that I'm referring to?
Harking back to earlier this episode,
yeah,
it did occur to me, and I went, I'm not going to look that up. That seems like too much work. Oh, well.
Because it also has become a bit of a blur to me in terms of recording and editing out of sequence. I can no longer remember, and there are lots of bits in the episodes where you're like, 2 weeks ago we said this, and it was wildly not that time. And that's the end of the episode.
Nope.
Nope.
Because we have one more Statler and Waldorf to talk about.
Right.
They also talk about nudity.
Because Waldorf asks Statler, how does he feel about nudity?
And Statler says, it always leaves him cold.
Solid joke.
Yep.
Solid much better,
like ice.
A much better joke to end this episode on than the actual Statler and Waldorf joke that ended this episode.
Absolutely. So we've reached the end of our coverage of the episode, so let's talk about some of the statistics for the episode. Ben, I've started a mini new segment, which is, what's been your feeling on how much music was in this episode? You made a comment earlier about Nancy Walker's song in the dressing room being so short, and I confirmed that by saying it was only 49 seconds long. Where do you think this episode lies?
I think this is our new shortest amount of music in the season so far.
Ding, ding, ding. We have a new leader in the clubhouse as far as not a lot of music. 9 minutes and 26 seconds, I believe. That's how the decimal place works out. 9.47 minutes of music compared to 26.47 minutes of episode. 35.78%.
Now, you did a couple episodes ago a rundown of the prior seasons showing just how big of a spread there had been. A bigger spread than I remembered. How does this compare to shortness in the previous season?
the least amount of music is the aforementioned Harvey Korman episode.
Okay.
With 7.72 minutes.
Okay, so 7 3/4 is our record to beat.
Yes, that is the floor for music. We've discussed it already, but there were 6 hits we established through the recording of this episode. 14 explosions and 1 very strange human and Muppet kiss.
1 very dry kiss.
And then for the ranking, we may have discussed this earlier. In rewatching it, I thought the dancing was great. The lunch counter sketch was a solid sketch. Mm. And all of the backstage bits that Nancy Walker was involved in were very good. And as we may discuss in our next segment, our top 5 moments, I might have a few moments that are Nancy Walker specific. Mm. So initially I put her at like 17, 18. And then once I realized that, I moved her all the way up to 11, which is 1 below Rich Little. Rich Little is a 10. Do I remember anything that Rich Little did right now? No. But my instinct was...
Boy, these rankings, are you just thrown them all into absolutely useless territory by saying you can't remember from episode to episode how you actually feel about the prior rankings?
Ben, that was episode 2. This is episode 6. That's so long ago.
Oh, man. The floor of music may be 7.74 minutes, but the floor of you having any credibility to anything you say has just fallen below.
Wait.
Utah.
Things have come back to me. I remember the backstage impression segment. That was Rich Little, right?
Yeah, I just said it earlier this episode.
Didn't remember.
Yeah, but that's why I remember.
Like
when people ask a question that somebody else has asked because they sort of dimly remember it in the back of their head, but they think it's their own thought process.
Listen, you inceptioned me remembering Rich Little episodes.
It's true, I did.
So yeah, I put it 1 lower than Rich Little. What are you going to do about it?
Nothing.
Exactly.
Nothing.
They're my rankings.
Except criticize and undermine you at every opportunity, much like Nancy Walker did to Fosse.
How dare you? I'd expect nothing less.
Well, let's get into, since you're clearly going to be talking about Nancy Walker a little bit longer while you can still remember what she did, into the
Who?
5. That's what she says.
But I got everything under control now, Miss Walker.
Miss Ho?
Oh, Walker, isn't that right?
In the 5 favorite moments of the episode, a moment is not a full sketch, but it's an aspect of performance, line delivery, screenwriting, or production that we particularly want to highlight that we may have glossed over earlier. And I'm going to start by talking not about a Nancy Walker moment, but about a Fancy Talker moment. I thought that the interplay, as I mentioned, the interplay between Gonzo and Fozzie in this episode was great. And it may have been designed to kill time, but thinking back at moments that people love about the Muppets, there's that viral video that they did in order to prove the concept that the Muppets could interact in a real-life environment in order to convince people that the Muppet movie should get made. And they had Frank and Jim improvising dialogue while in front of a tree and talking to a cow over a fence. And that energy of we're just doing spontaneous in-the-moment bits is crackling energy that Muppet audiences like. And there's some of that here with Fozzie and Gonzo. And perhaps the best bit is when the two of them are fighting over the telephone.
Gonzo, what are you doing to me?
I was only trying to tell Kermit what a great job you're doing.
I'll tell him. Give me the phone.
All right.
But the one I wanted to highlight was, as I say, the Fancy Talker bit, where Gonzo comes in and says, when you say Nancy, don't remember it by saying it rhymes with fancy. And Walker changes from Talker, and that's how you can remember that Nancy Walker is who you need to introduce, but don't say Fancy Talker. It's great sabotage of Fozzie, and it's well constructed in it's enough of a bit that you're expecting it to turn into Fozzie then saying, and now welcome Fancy Talker.
But they don't do that.
They don't. So it's great misdirection.
Mm-hmm.
For something that may have been not formally written, it's incredibly good structure because I was sitting there waiting for one punchline and they sucker punched me with a completely different direction. And both the energy of Gonzo in this sketch and the fact that I was sitting here secure in my I can predict comedy and punchlines knowledge and it was still unexpected was really good.
For my first moment, our second moment, I am going to do something that I have also done lots recently, which is cheat.
So you're not a wife guy.
No, wife guys are out now because they don't exist. You mentioned fancy talking.
I did.
And you mentioned wrestling over a phone.
Yes.
I'm going to talk about phones.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of phone business in this episode.
Ah, I see. You're going to cheat by doing a couple of different moments and calling it under the umbrella of phone bits.
Yep. In the first backstage segment, Fozzie picks up the base of the phone instead of the receiver and starts talking into it when he's talking to Kermit.
Very funny.
Very good. After Piggy hi-yahs the phone off the table and she leaves Nancy Walker holding just the receiver, Nancy Walker picks up
the split end of the cord,
the loose end, and says, I think we've got kind of a bad connection here, looking directly at camera.
Boy, did I forget about that, too, when I made my earlier no two camera bits. I forgot two of them. That felt improvised.
Yeah.
That felt really improvised, and yet I loved it as a bit.
And so again, when I re-went through the episode, and I saw that and the dancing, these were all reasons why I was like, no, she's got to be higher. Mm. Because that was just so funny. So I only had two moments. But there were lots of phone bits because Jim wasn't around, so there was lots of phone stuff. But those were the two that really stood out to me.
For my second moment, the third moment, the middle moment, I'm going to talk about the bird section. When the bird storms in and grabs the man out of the chair, he clearly can't be picked bodily up out of the chair and stuffed into the bird cage while he's still being puppeteered. And so he hangs limply from the giant chicken's hand. And yet, his facial expression is so perfect. It's as if he's being puppeteered. They have the exact right angle of the head and his jaw falling open without a hand in it. That it is confusion, amazement, and utter distress all at once. And that is either exceptional exterior puppeteering on the part of the chicken man, or it's fantastic puppet design on the part of the designer so that when he has resting panic face, it conveys everything you need. I was really impressed with how animated that totally vacant puppet was during that shot.
For my final moment, our fourth moment, the ring finger moment, if you will, I'm going to yet again mention something Nancy did in the dance number with her and Sweetums. And this may not technically be a Nancy Walker moment. This is more of a sound design moment. Because there's a point where Sweetums embraces Nancy Walker while she's singing. And Nancy has a line, but it's muffled.
Poop away on my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me.
But as we've discussed, they're not live singing. So they recorded it with her voice being muffled. Because they knew what the choreography was going to be. Mm. And so that bit of sound engineering or sound design that they got to make it clear but muffled, I really, really loved that detail.
For my final moment, our final moment, the final moment of the moments, I would like to once again point out that Scooter's character is all over the map in this episode. For him to be hyper-prepared so that he wrote a fake note for Nancy Walker in order to motivate Fozzie to go on stage is totally out of character, but I love the magazine bit. It's such a weird zig. He's not doing something comedic. He's not trying to tell a joke. He's not trying to be Fozzie or Kermit in that moment. He's just doing something that has absolutely no place on a stage. And it establishes character and reality of the wider world of it. And it's so weird and unpredictable that I wanted to point it out as an exceptionally interesting piece of writing, that they went someplace totally unexpected instead of the regular response would have been to have him try and fill the shoes of the other people in that slot for a minute. Loved it. Well done.
Yeah, it's great. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and Archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Combs, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we sure hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, unattributed bird names, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest in contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
We'll see you next time on The Muppet!
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 8, guest starring Steve Martin. Yay!